Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Sunstone Firesides podcast. I'm your host today, Malia Burgess Halstved, and I'm really excited to share something that I'm pretty passionate about, which comes from the mental health advocacy that I'm so interested in up here in Montana. So just as a point of fact for you guys, part of why I think this is an important topic to talk about is rates of children that have been removed from the care of their primary parent has been increasing pretty much all across the country. And I thought that this would be important to bring to this audience, because when I was growing up a young Mormon lass, I don't remember knowing anybody that was in foster care. And I remember there being this huge stigma against children who'd been removed from their parents. As I recall, it was almost always considered to be a drug thing. Like, oh, their parents are bad, their parents are mean, you know, rather than understanding that there could be some other reason. What I'm saying is it was very one note explanation for why children had been removed from their homes. So I thought that it would be interesting for this audience, hopefully, to understand from the perspective of two people who have a great deal of interaction with that type of thing. They have intimate knowledge of the foster care system. So what I've done is brought two amazing women on to talk to us. First, we have Ashley. That is not her real name. Ashley is a former CPS investigator, no longer works for CPS and can't speak on behalf of them, but I've asked her to come here to share her perspective as a CPS investigator. So Ashley, do you want to say hi?
Hey.
Thanks, Ashley.
Hi.
Good. Thanks. And I've also brought another very special guest on, my good friend Belinda, who spent... Belinda, how long did you spend in the foster care system?
A total of 8 years.
8 years. So I've asked Belinda to come on to share what I consider to be insightful, and I don't want to say interesting, because that kind of, it's not really interesting. It's heartbreaking in a lot of ways. But I do think we so rarely hear from foster children who have grown up about their experiences in foster care. So Belinda, I really appreciate you being here and sharing your experience with us.
I'm happy to help.
Awesome. Okay. So initially, I think that a lot of people, when they think about foster care, they think about, you know, a CPS investigator knocking on a door and everyone's terrified. And then the CPS investigator just walks right in and is like, you're being a bad parent, scoops up the kids, and they run to a cop car. I feel like that's what people tend to think about when they think about a child being removed from the home and into foster care. But, and maybe Ashley, you can speak to this. It seems to me that it actually begins a lot sooner than that. And it's not as easy as walking in and seeing what a house looks like and wanting to remove.
No, it is definitely not. And in my experience, there is never a situation where you want to remove a child. Not only do you not want to, but it is not legal. So once we get a report coming across the desk, it is called into our centralized intake. This is from Montana, so I can't speak to any other states. Sure. They vary some.
Sure.
But I don't think that it's a huge inconsistency between different places. The reports will come in, they're prioritized according to the level of concern, the threat level that could potentially be posed to the child, age of the child is considered as well.
And when you say age, does that mean that the child is too young to really verbalize if something's going on in the home, there's going to be a higher standard held for that, or am I misinterpreting?
When I say age of the child, it links directly to that child's vulnerability. Ability to verbalize would definitely be a concern simply because they wouldn't be able to express whether or not they're being hurt or if something is going wrong. They wouldn't be able to explain that or talk to you about that. But then you also look, if you have a child who's crawling around on the floor versus a child who is up walking, maybe 10 or 12 years old, you have a lot different concerns about the cleanliness of the home, where wires, electrical wires are, that kind of thing is where that age comes into play pretty significantly.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. And just as we go into learning about Belinda's story here, would you mind telling us just very roughly what were some, or I guess the most prevalent reasons that you ended up removing children ultimately?
The things that we have to be able to prove to the court when we bring in our affidavits are that this child was a victim of abuse or neglect resulting in or could result in significant risk to the child, being risk meaning to their physical health, that they could potentially be killed, or their mental health. That piece is a little bit more difficult to prove depending on the scenario.
Yeah.
Especially if a lot of these families don't necessarily, they either can't afford or don't really understand the importance of mental health. And so there's not a lot of therapists involved, licensed professionals. So those would be the kinds of things that we would have to prove to in a court of law in order to remove. So oftentimes those things come down to if a home, you know, people think a dirty house, but I think it's important to recognize how significant that needs to be.
They really give a couple chances, right? Like you don't walk in and see, you know, a messy house and be like, all right, we're taking the kids if you don't do your dishes, correct?
Absolutely. One home that I removed that was a dirty home, there was fecal matter all over the walls. It was impossible to actually move through the home without stepping on items. And the kids were 3 and 5. So at that age, you have a lot of fire risks. Obviously, fecal matter presents all kinds of issues with sanitation. There were pets in the home. There was dirty food that was rotting in reach of the children. So those are the kinds of things that could actually potentially cause significant risk. The family had, I believe, 2 weeks to work on that, wherein I checked in with them on every couple of days. One of the other issues with this was that this one of the younger children was escaping from the home and wandering around on train tracks and near a fairly busy highway. There were a lot of factors involved in this removal. It was not just the dirty home. Typically, that is the case. A dirty home has rarely been the case where we would remove for that. So that would be an example of neglect. Drugs were a big one, definitely a huge player in most of my cases. And the other big factor was domestic violence.
As in the child was witnessing it or being subjected to it?
There were a couple of different scenarios. There was one that was just a witness. Other times, kids would be involved. If you have a violent person in the home, a lot of times the children will fall victim to that same level of violence, even if it's sort of an incidental thing, that can happen.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ashley, for telling us particularly about the state of the home when it comes to removal. I think you might have known why that was important to talk about as we move over into Belinda's story. So, Belinda, do you mind giving us some quick background on your family situation? And then, you know, just take us through at whatever speed you want to. I find Belinda's story to be fascinating and really relevant for anyone who cares about children. So, Belinda, do you want to start off maybe telling us some of your earliest memories of your family?
Oh, goodness. Probably some of my earliest memories of my family were having woken up in the middle of the night and coming out and finding my mom passed out on the floor, still in her coat, coming in from her job. She would work until midnight at the airport. She would be the person you would pay for any short-term or long-term parking in the airport parking lot. I remember our house being dirty. I remember not having a lot of things, not having a lot of food. I remember when we moved into the house that ultimately my sister and I were removed from, I remember it being very clean when we moved in. My mother's great aunt had given my parents money for a down payment on a home. So we moved into that home and it was very exciting. And then even though we were in such a great place, things kind of went downhill from there. And I remember the first time I ever got grounded was when my father had a friend over and apparently they had golfed together previously, and I had told this gentleman that my dad pawned his golf clubs. I found out later that it was due to alcohol abuse and gambling issues. My parents had a lot of financial trouble, but those are my probably earliest. I was primarily responsible with taking care of my sister and making sure she was safe. And we were 3 years apart. She was born in 1986. I was born in 1983. And she had significant developmental delays. She was nonverbal. When we were living with my parents, she was nonverbal, exhibited a lot of signs of autism, later was diagnosed with autism. But my parents worked opposite shifts. And when one was home, they were either asleep or if it was on the weekends, just on the couch watching TV, not really paying attention to what we were doing. As far as food goes, the only meals that we got were at school. We never did have breakfast. We rarely had supper. And so we would get lunch from the school. There was a period of time where we would get breakfast at school, and the summer lunch program pretty much saved us all summer.
The summer lunch program being that you could go and have free lunch at the school site that was closest to you. Is that what you mean?
Right.
So if I can summarize, your little sister had some significant delays, and it sounds as if, and tell me if I'm wrong here, Belinda, that it might have been exacerbated by your parents' inability to care for the both of you, in that she was pretty nonverbal for most of her childhood. And it sounds like you guys weren't fed enough. Sounds like you guys were hungry a lot of the time. Would you say that that's true?
Yes, I would say that's definitely true. I was able to gain more nutrition being over at friends' houses during mealtimes or spending the night or whatever. My sister didn't really have that ability. Her disability largely prevented her from having any relationship or communication with anyone outside of the home. So she was basically just subject to however she was treated at home. And so I was undernourished. Dawn was malnourished, and certainly she had no intervention, no care to help develop her.
No trusted adult for her to call on to help her. Is that what you mean by an intervention?
Right. There was no one that took care of her.
So you were kind of her primary caretaker, and you were just a child yourself. Can you describe the difference from when you would be at home with your family and then you would go to your friend's house? What were the differences that you noticed between your home and their home? Because I'm just interested to see what it was like from your perspective. Not fully, I'm assuming that you didn't fully understand how atypical your childhood was.
No, but there were a lot of cues that I gained just by being in other people's homes. Their homes were clean. They didn't stink. I mean, their homes smelled nice. Their clothes were always clean. They had, like, I don't know, they brushed their teeth even, you know, we didn't even have toothbrushes. They had meals regularly and they had snacks. And I didn't really realize, I knew that my family was poor and that was part of the problem. So I attributed what I was experiencing to being impoverished. I didn't equate it to abuse or neglect or anything until much later in my life. I did have instances of embarrassment. There was a lot of, I guess I had a lot of pride. Friends' parents would try to give me their hand-me-down clothes, and I would not. I would refuse to wear them because I refused to show that we needed them. I remember one particularly embarrassing time. We never had socks. My grandma remarked that one time when we came to visit her, we had two socks, not two pairs, two socks between the two of us. I took my shoes off at a friend's house and my shoes didn't fit well and I didn't have socks and my feet were basically rotting and the smell was so bad that I couldn't have my shoes in their house. So just some real, I guess there was a lot of shame in it. A lot of shame came from seeing how other people lived and how we couldn't live like that.
That's interesting that you really attributed it to poverty at the time rather than neglect. Was that a narrative that your parents had instilled in you, or is that something that you came up with on your own?
That I can't really tell you. I know that as a child, I would never ask for anything. And I speculate that from a very young age, I was told that we couldn't afford things. I can't tell you for sure, but I know that the idea of asking for something from my parents made me sick to my stomach. And so I would never dream of asking them to buy anything specifically. I would never ask for toys. I would never ask for food. I would never ask them to buy anything. And always my understanding was that we couldn't afford it.
So even say to ask for dinner in the summertime, that would have been something that you just would not have.
It never would have crossed my mind to ask my parents to make food ever.
Okay. So Belinda, I'm wondering if you can walk us through, I know because you shared some of your story with me, that you had a friend whose mother either saw your home or saw some of your home. And that's what really started your journey into the foster care system. So I'm wondering if you can just kind of walk us through what happened.
Yeah. So my friend was able to spend the night at my house. I think it was pretty horrifying for her thinking back on it. And she reported what the living conditions were like and probably reported that she had no dinner, things of that nature, back to her mother. And I remember her mother coming to visit my mother, and because she wanted to see the house for herself, and my mom wouldn't let her in the house. So they just spoke on the porch. And my friend's mother was concerned for our welfare. So she contacted my grandparents. And my grandparents said, yes, this is what is going on. And we just don't know what to do about it. And so this woman decided that it would be a good idea if the two of them, my grandparents and her, would conference call Department of Family Services and just report their concerns and what they knew of our living situation.
Belinda, can you tell us how old you were approximately at this point?
I was 8 or 9 when the investigation began. And when I was finally placed in foster care, my sister and I was 10 and she was 8 at the time.
Okay, awesome. So please continue on. So your friend's mom gets with your grandparents and says, you know, we need to move on this, that these two children are not getting what they need. And then what happens?
So an investigation began and father had been in bed for quite a while. Dawn and I were still awake, just playing, and somebody came to the door. And of course, we would not open the door for anyone. So I woke my dad up and my dad went to the door and I could hear the people on the other side of the door talking. And my dad just kept saying, this is not a good time. This is not a good time. And I don't know what finally happened that they were able to convince him that they should come in the house, but they did come in the house. And the woman, it was a woman and a man, and the woman dry heaved. And I remember thinking, why is she at work if she is sick? Like, she needs to go home. Looking back on it now, I know that she was physically sickened by the condition we were living in. It was pretty surreal. I had been told that DFS was a group of people that would take you away and give you to strangers, and distrust of Department of Family Services was instilled at me very early, which looking back on it now, I realize that my parents knew that there was a risk that we might be investigated by Department of Family Services, that they knew what was going on was not healthy for us.
So they almost anticipated that it was going to happen?
Right. Because I remember being aware of what Department of Family Services was when they came and visited our home.
Wow. Had your parents done any coaching of you prior? Or, I mean, maybe you can understand now as a grown up, if they had been saying, like, preparing you for this situation?
Well, in my example, early on, when I told my father's friend that my father had pawned his golf clubs, that is when I learned that we don't tell people what happens inside our home, and that we are in no way to ever tell anybody how we're doing at all, or that we're struggling at all.
Okay. So now, and I understand that your perception of your home at the time was definitely through the eyes of a 10-year-old, but would you mind describing, you know, why had she come in and started dry heaving? Can you explain what was going on in your house?
we had a lot of garbage in our home. I remember cleaning our house maybe 3 times in the time that I lived with my parents. So 3 times in 10 years. And the way that we would clean our house is we would start from the very front of the house, and my dad would take a broom and just sweep everything that he could, push, basically shovel all of the garbage from the floor into the kitchen. And our kitchen would be full up past my knees. And my mother and I would use dustpans and just shovel dustpans of garbage into bags.
Wow.
We had rotting. When we did have food, there would be whatever leftovers would be rotting, out rotting. My mother had cups of leftover Canadian mist that fruit flies had died in. We had several stray animals that had gotten into our basement and died there. We had no running water in the kitchen. So if we ever did do dishes, they would be done in the bathtub. Our toilet didn't flush. So there was that to deal with, or that you can imagine a small house and a toilet that doesn't flush does not lend itself to a very pleasant environment. It was pretty bad.
And to you, did it seem normal, or did you know at this point that it was just atypical?
I always dreamed of having a clean house. I again attributed our house not being nice due to not having money. I used to watch the movie Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. And in the movie, that house is it is pretty nasty. It wasn't as bad as our house, but it was pretty nasty. And the kids in the house clean the house and it looks immaculate. And it's like it increases the value of the home like $100,000. So I would always get inspired when that movie was on to get up and start cleaning the house, because I thought maybe if I would just clean our house, it would be like the one on Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. And I would quickly get frustrated and tired because it was just too much for me to do on my own.
And especially since you were essentially a child, I mean, you were 10 years old, even at the very end, it would probably have been an impossible task for a 10-year-old. So you've taken us to the point where the investigators have come over, they've entered into the home, one investigator is retching, and you're trying to understand why this person is sick, when in reality, we know now that really it was such a repulsive place to be, with all sorts of rotting animals and just a lot of general unpleasantness. Can you tell us what happened next to the best of your memory?
As far as I knew, nothing happened until school was over. And I can't really place when the investigation started in relation to school ending, but it had to be close. Once school ended, my sister and I were permitted to stay with my grandparents on the condition that my grandparents would not bring us back to my parents' home until they'd gotten approval from DFS. In the beginning, it was just a cleanliness issue. And so they had given my parents a lot of time to clean the home, and then they're also continuing their investigation. Ultimately, by the end of the summer, we needed to go to school and we couldn't stay with my grandparents. And so we did end up in foster care. Then upon further investigation, there were some other abuse issues that were uncovered, and it was determined that we should not be returned to our parents.
Okay, so initially you were removed from the home due to the cleanliness of the home, which Ashley had already told us can sometimes be the cause for a primary removal, especially if it's an unsafe condition. So I'm wondering if you can tell us initially when you went into your first foster care placement, can you talk to us a little bit about what that was like and where you went?
That was probably the craziest thing that I've ever experienced in my life, is having to move into a stranger's home with other children and just live life like we hadn't just had our entire world exploded. We moved in with a wonderful woman. At the time when we moved in with her, she was 70 years old. She had two other foster children at the time, and she moved us into our own room. I remember thinking it was really lovely. We each had our own bed. Each bed had a mattress and a box spring, which is not something that I had experienced anywhere except for friends' houses and my grandparents' house. The beds had sheets and a comforter and really nice pillow. I was just like blown away that these would be our beds and that's what we would be sleeping in. This particular foster parent really believed in keeping families together, and she would try her best if she had room to take families together to minimize as much as you can minimize the trauma. So the first thing that my foster mother did was take us to the store. We didn't really have anything of our own. So she felt it was really important for us to go and pick out shampoo and conditioner and soap and all of these things, a toothbrush, which would be the first toothbrush I really owned, toothpaste. And I think she realized that even though it would be more economical for all of us kids to share shampoo and conditioner and a tube of toothpaste, she realized that it was important for us to have our own things. And so that was all very exciting. We also, the first day, went to eat at JB's, which was like a little family diner, kind of like a Denny's, super family friendly, and ate out, which we never ever did. And that was fantastic. And then when nighttime came, I realized what it meant that we were going to be going to bed in this home and we wouldn't be going home. And that's when I just fell apart. I cried for an entire week straight. I woke up crying. I went to bed crying. Even though the place that I went was better and provided for me more, it was just a huge heartache to leave what I had known my whole life.
Sure. And that's something that I think is not well understood by the general public. There seems to be this idea that, you know, a child who is being neglected or abused is removed from the home and the child is like, this is so good. Thank you, you know, Savior, for bringing me here. And at least the children that I've worked with, I have not worked with a child. And Ashley, maybe you can speak to this as well, that it seems to me that the majority of children who are removed from the home want to be reunited with their family of origin, with their family of birth. Would you say that that's true, Ashley?
Absolutely. I mean, even as adults, we are drawn to the things that we're more comfortable with. And with a child's level of understanding and ability or inability to adapt to new things right away and understand fully what everything means and what the consequences of everything are, want to go home. However bad or good or whatever, it's something that you know and you know what to expect.
Right. And I think, and maybe you can speak to this, Belinda, for a child, even if the routine is less than ideal, to put it lightly, that at least it's a routine, and that sometimes it can be really jarring for a child, even who an abused child, to have to go into a new situation. And I mean, it sounds clearly like your first foster home was superior in every way and you cried for a week wanting to go home.
Right. It was different from anything that I knew. I was away from my parents. And while they were not healthy part of my life, I missed them terribly. Mm-hmm. I missed my home. I missed room and my bed, even though it was a box spring with no sheets and I was going to get to sleep in this antsy bed. I missed what I knew. I missed my normal.
Okay, so your sister and yourself are placed in this foster home, which is pretty much superior in just about every way. Yet you're still missing mom and dad. And I'm going to go ahead and assume, tell me if I'm wrong, that you are wanting to eventually go back home to your mother and your father. Is that true?
That's what's interesting. I don't remember actually wanting to go back. I missed not being home and I missed my parents, but I think on some level, I knew that we shouldn't go back, and that became more apparent as time went on.
And with having a little bit more regular nutrition and stuff, did you notice any changes in your body right away? Or was it just kind of, were you able to gain that nutrition that you and your sister both needed?
That is also another thing that I've realized recently, actually. I have always remembered my sister being very malnourished. Her knees were bigger than the rest of her leg. And I've always thought that I was fairly healthy when I went into foster care. And I found my report card from before I went to foster care. And at that time, they would weigh you and put your height on your report card. And
yeah, I
weighed
that.
35 pounds.
You weighed 35? 3.5?
35 pounds, yeah.
And you were 10?
3.5.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yes. So, wow. And I could remember not being able to see over the counters. So I was very underweight and not as tall as I should be. So we started eating, and my foster mother was very good about making sure that we had all food groups represented. I thought that was something only wealthy people did. And I thought my grandparents must be the richest people in the world because they did this at every meal. And I just felt like every meal they had was like Thanksgiving. But it turns out most people will have meals multiple times a day and multiple food groups represented. So then the growing pains started. I had the most intense growing pains, and they would start after I'd fall asleep. I would wake up with these intense pains in my legs, and my foster mother would have to walk me up and down the hallways and try to just relieve those muscles and get all of that tension to release. And she would give me Tylenol and try to do as much as she can, but there was just not much you could do. My body finally had fuel to grow, and it needed to catch up. So
sure. Did your sister also gain a lot of weight? Because it sounds like she was even more malnourished than you were.
She did gain quite a bit of weight. She benefited a lot from foster care. But yes, notably right away, she did gain weight.
Okay. So walk me through what's happening now with your case from your perspective. Had you been having visits with your mother and father, or had you just been out of contact?
Initially, I was having visits with my mother. I remember meeting at the DFS office and having visits with her, and they would be an hour a week. My father was not coming to visitation, I would suspect, because he wasn't doing his part of whatever he was required to do in order to gain visitation. But at that point, I thought that my parents were just needing to work on cleaning the house. And so I assumed that that was what was going on. It obviously was not going on.
You're hopeful at this point that you headed home?
I don't know if I was hopeful, but I did think that it was going to happen at that point. I think at that point, I was starting to get comfortable at the foster home. After about a week of being devastated, I woke up one morning and I just couldn't cry anymore. I woke up and started to cry, and I couldn't cry. And I was just, I don't know. Kids are resilient, and I think that my brain just couldn't let me suffer anymore. I guess it was just ready for me to kind of move forward. So my sister wasn't quite there. She talked about wanting to go home a lot, not in words. She was still mostly nonverbal. She spoke her own language, and only I could really understand her. So for the first quite a while, I was the interpreter between Dawn and my foster mom. She definitely was, and still does to this day, wish that she could live with her mom.
Okay. So even today, she wishes that she could live with your mom, and maybe not totally. Do you believe that she's aware of the neglect and the abuse? Or do you think she just, like, do you have any insight for that with her?
I'm not really sure what it is that she thinks her life would be like if she lived with my mom. There's just no way for me to know. I think it is rooted in the fact that she just never has gotten over that major change and that you're supposed to live with your mom and she didn't.
So possibly because maybe she does have some developmental delays. It sounds to me like she's stuck almost in some ways where you were when you were a child, really wanting to go home or missing your parents, even though you knew you were in a better place, still wanting, having that desire to go back home, even today.
I certainly think that's a possibility. It is really, you know, Dawn has her disability is such that she can't really express that. But I think it's certainly a possibility that is what it is.
Okay, so you've been placed in this foster home. Can you tell us just from kind of like a faraway perspective? Because I want people to know that we have a happy ending here, as happy as we can hope for in a situation where a child's being profoundly neglected and essentially abused as you and your sister were. How long were you in this foster home that you had been initially placed in?
I was in this same foster home for 8 years, and my sister was in the same foster home for 12. So, he was 8. So she was in for 13 years, the same foster home.
Okay.
So we were both in the same place together until we basically graduated that system.
Ashley, can you speak to that long of a placement? Is that atypical or is that to be expected in the foster system?
That is the dream, but it is not always feasible. There's a lot of different factors come in. Sometimes when you have an emergency and it's 2:30 in the morning, there are homes that are specifically set up for short term. So they are ready at a moment's notice, but then they don't have that ability really to then keep kids with them the whole time because they need to maintain that ability to be ready at a moment's notice and have the beds for kids to sleep in. Then there's situations where people get into a spot that they didn't expect. You know, there's a lot of training that goes into the foster care program to help people be prepared. There's a lot of respite situations set up for families so that they can maintain for kiddos.
And Ashley, can you tell us just really quickly, what is a respite care situation compared to, you know, like a regular foster care placement?
Oh, sure. Yeah. The respite, each child is allotted an amount of time. It's essentially a babysitter, really. But typically what will happen is, say the foster family has someone in their biological family that passes away and they want to travel to go to the funeral. So they may be gone for a weekend or maybe even for a week if they needed to do something along those lines. And it's really not necessarily something that a foster kiddo needs to go through. Mm-hmm. So they would be placed into another foster home just for that brief period of time.
Okay.
It would just be like staying at a friend's house.
Okay. And I would imagine that those homes, like you said, are set up for a completely different situation than foster care that's meant for long-term, like the one that Belinda and her sister had ended up in.
It totally depends. Anyone can do it who is a licensed provider. So it could be a regular foster home. A lot of foster parents communicate with each other. They have a lot of similar stressors and support one another. So a lot of times these kids will know these other foster parents and they'll feel pretty comfortable. So sometimes it is just a regular foster home.
So they can almost refer to someone who maybe honestly, like foster parents need a break or they're going on vacation or something. They can place the child in this respite care for a short amount of time. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, I'm Stephen Carter. Since 1975, Sunstone Magazine has been publishing the best of Mormon thought and experience. And now, Sunstone is also a podcast where you can listen to audible quality recordings of our best articles, essays, stories, and poetry, both new and classic. Come get a taste with our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. We look forward to being a part of your journey.
So there's definitely different types of foster homes, but the one that Belinda ended up in was a very long-term, and from what it sounds like, loving foster home. And Belinda actually, I don't know what you call it, graduated from the foster care system and moved into adulthood, young adulthood, which is, I think, safe to say, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ashley, that is a very vulnerable time for kids that are in the foster system, that transition from childhood into young adulthood.
Yes, simply because young adults can be idiots, as we all were.
What? And no, not me.
Right? So essentially, you know, you goof up, you overdraw your checking account, and so you'll call your mom and she'll help you out. Where a lot of foster kids wind up when they're exited, when they leave the system, they don't have any backup. There's not a backup plan.
Yeah. Where would they go? I mean, I would assume there are some, are there like nonprofits set up to help this transition from foster care into a young adulthood?
Yes. So there are transitional living programs. One is one of the CHAFE programs, which is a nationwide program. They offer financial assistance. They can give you $500 toward a car. They help you get a computer set up. They definitely have their protocol that they have to follow. So kids sure. need to going to school, or just depending on the program, there's grants written specifically to get that funding. Here in Billings, there is the Tumbleweed program has a transitional living program where kids are required to work or go to school full time, depending on where they're at. But then they get to live there for free. They have to do their chores. There's no substance abuse. They meet with a social worker and a counselor on a regular basis. And then Youth Dynamics is another program or another organization here in town that does a similar set up as that. They get kids into, they actually do, they get them into their own apartments. They check in and then the child is, they help them get set up so they have, you know, all the stuff like bed and a couch and a, you know, maybe a TV or some dishes. And then the child is to take over that rent. They slowly get that figured out.
Kind of like wean them off a little bit, maybe exactly. Slowly. Okay. What's kind of disturbing to me, and those programs are awesome, but just that there is so, that it's not, it sounds like it's probably run off of grants rather than being administered by the state or the federal government. It sounds like it's just almost from the federal government's point of view or the state government's point of view. Once you hit that age of majority, okay, go ahead.
You're a grown up. Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Here's your backpack, you know, like, bye.
Right.
I just can't imagine I think back to how I was, as you put it, pretty stupid at that age. Like, I couldn't have figured out anything on my own without my parents helping me.
As a caseworker, it is definitely something that's part of your day-to-day when you have the older kids, because they are going to be on their own. So part of I had a pretty large group of older kids who were getting ready to turn 18 and had zero familial support. And didn't necessarily have a great head on their shoulders. So one of the things that we do is we kind of toured through a lot of the organizations in town that can help to bail you out. Being familiar with nonprofits in town that are, you know, family services, and how to find more if you needed them. Like, reach out to your local hospitals, things like that. Working through the Social Security office to kind of familiarize them with a lot of those things. When they do then are ready to age out, they are provided with everything, all of their legal documents, all of those things. And the hope is that in the last period of time that you've had with this child, you've been able to get them set up in a way that they can take care of themselves.
Gotcha. So it's really incumbent on the CPS worker to prepare these young people to leave foster care. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think it would probably depend on the case, but in my situation, it definitely was.
Okay. And that's something that I kind of want to address, and maybe Belinda can speak to this too from inside the situation, is turnover is what I want to talk about inside the department, CPS workers. So here in Montana, to be a CPS worker, I believe you have to have a college degree in a related field like sociology, social work, psychology. And is there a 1-year requirement of experience working something like that? Does that sound right to you, Ashley?
I'm remembering 2 years.
2 years.
I am not confident that that's accurate.
Sure. Important to note, here in Montana, we have had such a large explosion of children that are being placed in foster care. I think that we have doubled our numbers, I want to say, since the early aughts of number of children placed in foster care. And it's been really kind of this huge crisis. I think it's safe to call it a crisis. And there have been lots of ideas about why so many kids are being placed in foster care. And some of the blame has been placed, if you want to call it blame, some of the root cause of it has been placed on drugs, like Ashley talked about. Some of it has been placed on just, sounds kind of offensive, but poverty-related reasons being unable to provide for the child. But one idea put forth that I think is really interesting is that caseworkers, CPS caseworkers, people who work for the department, being undertrained or untrained. Do you want to speak to that, Ashley, at all about what it takes to be a CPS investigator, people that are making these, what I assume would be really tough decisions about where a child should live?
Oh, where do I start? I don't know. I think in Montana in the last, with these doubling numbers, if you look at when our population started to get bigger, one big draw, we had a lot of people coming to this region because of the money that the oil fields brought in. But it's kind of the way of things as the world seems to be getting smaller. So it's just kind of inevitable, I think. And training is definitely a problem. I know when I started working, it was 2 years before one of my coworkers was to retire. She had worked in Wyoming and in Montana and had done CPS work in both places her entire life. She is a wonderful, wonderful woman. And she primarily focused on investigations. And one of the things that she said was so difficult was she said the last 5 years have been the worst 5 years in this department, that she loved working there previously. And it had been a stress for the last 5 years simply because of unmanageable numbers. And with that, and she said that she would have quit had she not been so close to retirement. And so I know that, and I, it played in heavily when I chose to leave the department.
So what you're saying is your caseload was too high. You had too many kids to care for, essentially.
Yes.
Can you tell us about what the average caseload would have been at your time that you were at the department?
The numbers that we heard that were supposed to be a healthy caseload is between 20, around 20 to maybe 30. That's pretty high. Typically, people in the department were carrying caseloads of 50 and above.
My goodness. And I think it's important for us to note that those case numbers, that those children, a great majority of those kids are in custody, essentially, of the state. So the person who's in charge of making those important life choices for those kids that are in custody of the state are those caseworkers. And if you've got 50 kids, I can't even wrap my head around that.
Right. And there is where you do have to watch out for concerns, because the people who are in charge, then they've recently made some changes, but at the time that I was there, they would have 6 people in their unit. So if each of those 6 people has 50 kids, then you're talking 300 kids under your most experienced supervisor.
Wow. Okay. Belinda, can you speak to, did you have one consistent caseworker or did you have many back? And I realized that this was in the 80s and the early 90s, but I'm just wondering if you experienced that from your perspective as a child.
Listen, it was the early 90s.
Sorry.
To 2000.
Okay, that's right. Sorry.
I was really lucky to have only 2 caseworkers. The first one I loved. The second one I didn't. I still actually interact with the first one when given the opportunity, and not with the other one if I have the opportunity. But I was lucky in that respect too, that I didn't see a lot of turnover in that way. I had a very unique experience in the foster care system where I had a very stable home, very stable caseworker situation. And it was just, I had an amazing experience. Lots of people who are in the system for as long as I was will go through more than one. They'll average out more than one foster home a year.
Wow.
And I don't know how many social workers they would go through, but I remember at the time being told how lucky it was that I got to stay in the same foster home with my sister for the entirety of the state having custody of us.
I hate to say, you know, that you were lucky. Like, I hear you say that, and I'm like, oh, Belinda, but you know, you've been through so much with your family. But I can't even imagine what it would have been like if you had a rotating group of foster homes, or if you and your sister had been separated, which unfortunately does happen, even though I know caseworkers really try to keep these sibling groups together. But I mean, I just can't imagine what that would have looked like for you.
Certainly, the odds were already stacked against me to have a functional adult life. I think that the foster home that I was in greatly contributed to me having a fantastic adult life. I think if I had been in a home that was less great than the one I was in, it would have been detrimental to
me. Also, if I had to move from home to home, certainly it would have been detrimental to me. And I think I can definitively say that I would not have as successful or happy an adult life.
Definitely.
Because that consistency, that feeling of safety, that feeling of consistency, having a refuge, feeling like I belonged somewhere made a huge difference in how I saw the rest of the world. I didn't have to worry about belonging, so I could focus on things beyond that.
So just to kind of, I realize I've been bringing us all around. So I want to finish or have Belinda express the end of her story here. So you were in this foster home a long time. Your parents, I'm assuming, did not take the steps that they needed to take in order to gain custody back of you and your sister.
They did not. And one of the nicest things I think that Department of Family Services could do for us is keep us connected to our parents so that they were a regular thing in our lives, so we could take a moment away from where we were at in our nice foster home that smelled nice and had nice food and we had clean clothes and we had safety and security and the love of our foster mother, and just spend an hour or two a week with our parents and see how they were living. And I grew to be very, very, very thankful that I was in foster care.
Sure.
And quickly my goals became to have a better life than my parents. And it turned out that was really easy. So I had to make some new goals for myself pretty quickly in my young adulthood. But I now have guardianship of my sister. She's in a fantastic group home. She has a high quality of life. I still keep in contact with my foster mother, who is now, she will be 90, 94 this year.
And can we give a shout out to that woman?
She still keeps in contact.
She's just the greatest thing.
She is amazing. I remember one year she was nominated and won Foster Parent of the Month and then also Foster Parent of the Year. And so I really did have the very best foster parent Billings had to offer. And she's still a mentor for me today. She's an amazing woman. She lives her life saying, "In you know, at 94, you hear a lot of people say, I've had a good life. And she always says, I have a good life. She continues to live every day like as its own experience and continues to grow and change and just is a great inspiration to me and continues to mentor me and just be a good guide in my life.
You're a parent now too, right?
Yeah.
Parent, married.
Which has been amazing.
Yeah. Tell us about where you're at now.
I don't have any dead animals in my basement.
Oh, good.
I eat 3 meals a day. I don't live on a box spring. No, I'm in a wonderful place now. I moved out to my husband's family's ranch after being 10 years in the financial industry and my husband being an electrician. We decided to make a life change and move out to his family's ranch. And that gave us a great opportunity to start a family. So we decided to become ranchers and start a family. And I'm in pre-nursing and it's just amazing.
Oh, good for you. I mean, that's kind of an understatement, right? I'm so glad to hear that you have gone on to have this happy life after this, a little bit of a rocky start, to put it gently. I think your story is an important one, especially for those of us that maybe have not had much interaction with the foster care system. And certainly for people who have not ever had that experience, I really want to thank you for sharing this with us. And I know it sounds a little cheesy, but like, I honor your story and the struggle that you went through. And it, just speaking for myself, you know, I have to admit, Belinda's a good friend of mine. And she herself has inspired me to want to work with kids who are maybe underserved, to try to bridge those gaps for kids just with my own work. And I'm sure probably Ashley would say the same thing, that Belinda's an inspiration and that the hard work that you've put in to create your life is just amazing. So I'm really glad to hear that you're doing well and proud of you for everything that you've come through.
Well, it does have a lot to do with having an amazing foster parent. And I would just say, if there's anybody out there that feels like, you know, they could love another child that maybe they wouldn't get to keep for themselves, as hard as that would be, it's the most amazing gift that you can give to a child, is if you can give them that love and stability and that safety to help them make sense of this, the world that they've been thrown into. I would encourage you to become a foster parent.
Awesome. Okay. So if we can, I'm going to add some resources for people who are interested in becoming foster parents at the bottom here of this podcast, if that's something that you're interested in. I know here in Montana, our large population of foster care kids, that need has not been matched as far as foster homes go. And I would venture a guess that that's true for many areas around the country. So we need foster parents. We need good foster parents who are willing to make that long-term commitment like Belinda's awesome foster mom did. I'm going to go ahead and toss that up there at the bottom of this podcast. And I just want to thank Ashley and Belinda for coming on and sharing their stories from both sides of the fence, as it were. Thank you so much. And I appreciate you guys being on Sunstone Fireside Podcast. Anything else that you want to add? I do have one last question, if you guys are ready for it.
I'm ready.
Okay. So I'll ask Belinda first. So if you were going back and you were speaking to little Belinda, who is about to enter foster care, what would you tell her?
I don't know. Just do your best and you will be fine. Don't waste your time on worry. Just do your best and move forward and you will be just fine.
That's good advice for us all, I'm sure. Thank you. Now, Ashley, if you could go back to young Ashley, who's about to start her CPS work, and when you're all fresh-faced, can you share what you would have told to young Ashley who's starting out in the department?
Oh, get ready.
Don't do it.
Probably just make sure that you talk to the kids. It's the best part of the job. It's the part that matters the most. And with my kids, as they were aging out, I asked one of my girls, I said, what would you tell you if you, because I was asking her as far as her whole experience. I basically asked her what you just asked Belinda. And I said, what would your advice be to kids who are just coming into this whole deal? And she said that all these jerks are actually trying to help you like they say they are.
So true. So true. And it's hard. I think it's hard to believe in the moment, probably for some of the kids, because I feel like mental health people are constantly asking foster kids to do more than what they're used to and maybe more than what they're comfortable with. But I swear it's usually with good intent. Okay, awesome. Well, thank you again. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience, particularly Belinda and Ashley. Thanks so much for coming on and showing us what it's like from the perspective of a CPS worker. Sometime we'll have to get Ashley back on here to talk about the time she was protested against in front of her office saying how much she sucks. And yep. There were anonymous weird news articles written about her. It's not, you know, when you say that talking with the kids is the best part, that's what you're alluding to. Talking with some people, certain people, was not the best part. So
yep. There are definitely some not best parts.
Okay. Awesome, guys. Well, thank you so much for listening to the Sunstone Fireside Podcast, which is talking about events which affect Mormons and certainly the welfare of young people inside and outside of the church is something that we all have a vested interest in. So thanks for listening and say goodbye, Ashley and Belinda.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye.
The song you are listening to is titled Nostrand Avenue by Mormon artist Belle Jewell. You can support her and other amazing Mormon artists by downloading her album End of an Era by Belle Jewell or find her on Spotify.